Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening. My next guest is Teresa Sanders. Teresa earned a doctorate degree in 2012 in educational leadership and adult education and a master's degree in education curriculum and instruction. She has 14 years of experience teaching and also working as a special education behavior adjustment teacher. She also has 20 years of intensive mental health and social services experience. She is a well-known author, and her last book was published in spring of 2020. She is currently working in a micro school to meet the needs of students with significant behaviors who were otherwise left behind in public schools. Welcome to the podcast, Teresa.
Thank you.
Well, I find your story very interesting, and just wanted to reach out to you because of your experience working with kids in the special education environment, and now that you are in that micro school environment. But tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out, and then we'll talk a little bit about just kind of your beliefs and your educational background and kind of how you got to where you are now.
Okay. So when we talk about the trenches, public education is one big persistent trench, and teaching children within the confines of public education is a big trench. So when you talk about one of the trenches that I found myself out of, you know, I had a couple of different situations that I could talk about, and I thought about it, but really the biggest trench that I've come out of is leaving the public education system. The micro school that you speak of is one that I started. I developed it myself. And the purpose of Safari Small Schools, it's what it's called. The purpose of it is to provide education services, nothing magical, nothing mystical, just an education to the students whose needs are not being met in the traditional mainstream classroom. And for me, that coming out and taking a chance on my own skills and my own ability, that was my biggest climbing out of the trench, as far as, you know, finding myself in the trenches. However, for some of the actual school trench situations, one of the biggest that I would also like to share is I remember working with a young man who was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He was 8 years old. He had the auditory hallucinations, the visual hallucinations, but he was a sweet boy. I was able to close a 2 year reading gap in 1 year with him by focusing on reading instruction and literacy. Other things like social studies and science, I had to push back, but he was in the third grade and couldn't read. And I closed a 2 year gap with a boy with mental illness by focusing on the reading. My thoughts are, where would we be if we freed up teachers to actually teach the kids? Because in the behavior class, they're not expecting me to teach the kids. They just want me to keep peace in the classroom, make sure they're not hurting themselves or anyone else or breaking anything. So there's no real expectation that I'm going to teach them. However, when you have a small class and you enjoy being there and you have kids you really love and you care to actually teach, you can accomplish a lot. And that's why Safari Small Schools is a small school model, because it's easier to meet the kids' needs that way. So I'll never get rich just teaching in the classroom. I'll get rich other ways. But just teaching in my own classroom, I will know that kids are learning. In fact, somebody called me yesterday. Her son will be coming over Monday. 12 years old, this kid can't read.
Wow.
So I'll be working with him.
Wow. Can you tell me a little bit more about Safari Small Schools and just the model and the age of the students that you're working with, and maybe a little bit of their backgrounds if you're able?
So backgrounds vary. Backgrounds vary widely because there is no student in need. All students are in need. And so I'm pre-K through third. And the maximum students that I can enroll is five. It's a one room classroom like the schools of old. And so, of course, COVID put some blocks on what I'm able to do because everything is in one room. And it's a small room on top of that. There are pictures of it on my website on Safari Small Schools and on the Safari Small Schools Facebook page. But it has everything that you'll need for school. I have all the materials, curriculum, you know, all that stuff. But it's one kidney table with five chairs. I have another seating environment for books. So my students may have behavior issues. They may have developmental or learning disabilities, or they may not have any of that at all. And they can just benefit from a smaller learning environment. This young man who's going to come on Monday is 12. Now I'm pre-K through third. However, he can't read. So I can still serve him. And that's what I'm going to do. And I didn't want to find myself piecemealing serving kids. However, this is what I'm here for. His mother is, she's like, he'll be out of school on Monday. Can you work with him? I can work with him. He's 12. He's past my age range, but he can't read. So the COVID has presented a situation with us that there is no education model anymore. There are many different ways to do it. There are many different models. The micro school, and mine is a micro school because some micros have up to 150 kids. Mine is five because I know with me, I can do five. I can meet the needs of five kids. If I have more than that, then I have to get somebody else in there with me. And as time grows on, I will. But right now, that's not where we are. Right now, it's me and five kids. And that's the max I will deal with. And if there's some, maybe I'll get a kid with severe behaviors or a higher level of needs, it might be only three. And so it just depends. But for me and who I am as an educator and as a human being, this is my purpose work. This is what I love. This is what I care to do. So I am looking forward to COVID being out of here so I can really just go full force and just do what I want to do and do what I'm made to do.
And is this Safari Small School something you planned as schools were shutting down last year, or is this something that you've had kind of in the works for a while and then launched this in the fall of 2020?
I launched it in the spring of 2020 in March, and it's a vision that my nephew reminded me that I had more than 20 years ago, and I don't remember talking to him about it, but he says, yeah, you did. But I actually started writing it down in 2011. And as times, you know, moved on, I added components, I removed components, I added this, I took away that. And then as 2018, 2019, I started seeing I need to be able to, I can't control what everybody else does, but I can control what I do. And so the one thing I had to do was make it to where I can manage it. And five kids, because I've spent all my years in a behavior class with five, six kids, that I can manage. And so for me and my campus, that is what I do. The vision is to have other Safari Small School campuses nation and eventually worldwide, which will give teachers an opportunity to become what I call teacherpreneurs. That's not my statement. I stole that from somewhere. To become teacherpreneurs to where they can open their own small schools, New York, San Francisco, Boston, Las Vegas, wherever, because parents need options. The thing about Safari Small Schools, it's completely free of government intervention. So no government funding. I'm not sure, people ask me, how will vouchers work? I don't know. If they can spend the vouchers and not tell me what to do, then that's fine. But if the government needs to come in and tell me what to do, I don't want it. And the whole purpose of me getting away from the government, because look what the government schools, look what we have now, and they don't work. And I don't need any more government intervention to tell me how to teach kids. I need to learn how to effectively teach kids. That's a growing process, and I know how to teach. But things like dyslexia instruction and those types of things, those are things I didn't receive any training on. So those things I'm being trained on now, on my own, of my own volition. So I'm ready for kids with dyslexia using the Orton-Gillingham approach. And any kid, if I can meet their needs, then I'll serve them. And that's the way it is.
Yeah, I really like that approach too. If you're not sure of, you know, the field that, you know, you have to dive a little bit more deeper into, whatever need the child has, you're willing to learn that, right? Because you want to be able to support their needs. And I wanted to shift a little bit to, on your website, you share a lot about your beliefs. And something that you point out a lot is being the educator, student, family advocate. And I know that ties into why you've opened the small school. And what do you think, you know, regular public schooling is not providing for the families? Because, you know, we have a lot of families, and I've been in a school where they're, you know, they come in and out, and especially with those kids that have IEPs and 504s, and, you know, the public school doesn't always meet their needs. So talk a little bit just about, like, how, you know, standardized testing, you know, you on your website, you talk a lot about just the companies that get rich on standardized testing, and how, you know, that could be detrimental for the kids that, you know, have IEPs and aren't, you know, the test taking, you know, wizards that some of the other kids might be, but I'll let you go ahead and take that away.
Okay. So public schools, in my opinion, are not constructed to teach kids. And so that's what the book that I'm writing now is about. It's about showing interested stakeholders what public education is. If public education was about educating kids, kids would be educated, but they're not. And the failure of public education goes back decades, at least six in my research, 60 years of a failure. So for example, we have 4 million fourth graders, 3 million of them cannot read proficiently. The significance to that is when third grade is over, reading instruction for the most part stops. And fourth grade, kids are reading to learn. So if they're not proficient readers at the end of third grade, now they're moving to where they need to read to learn, and they're not prepared. So if they can't read and they have to read to learn, all they're doing is falling further and further behind. You can't tell me that in the United States, where money is not really the issue as far as education goes, we provide air-conditioned classrooms, heated bus service, meals, evaluations, eyes, ears, medical, the whole thing. Why aren't kids reading? We're supposed to be data-driven. Data drives instruction, but yet they're ignoring the data that everyone's failing. Kids are not reading. This is not just the kids with disabilities. This is the kids in the mainstream classroom as well. So I don't judge people's lofty homilies. I don't judge what your intentions are. I judge outcomes. The outcomes say you're failing. They don't involve parents. Through Title I, Title I funding is supposed to include spending on parental involvement activities. I don't know that I've worked at one school ever that did much to involve parents, especially when it costs money. But Title I funds are supposed to be spent on parental engagement activities. It's not happening because there's no oversight to see if it's happening or not. So if the schools don't spend that money on that, there's no penalty or consequence for that. So they're not really worried about it. So parents who are involved and who are, who have the sufficient ability or social sophistication to advocate for their children do, and they get hit with brick walls all the time. So when you have parents who don't have the same level of social sophistication or courage to advocate for their kids, they just kind of hang back. Well, schools are not reaching out and saying, hey, come and be a part of this. They're not. Public schools are not generally. You may have a few that, you know, that do, but as a whole, the system does not. They don't want parental involvement. And if they do want parents there, they want the parents that they can tell what to do and how to do it. Not the parents who will ask a bunch of questions, not the parents who are going to demand answers. They want the parents to bake the cookies, to watch the kids on the playground, but they don't want the parents who ask the hard questions. Wait a minute, why are our scores looking like this? You ask that question, you'll be the parent that they don't need anymore. So parents are not really welcome in the school environment. Public schools will tell you they are, but they're not.
Well, what do you think would be a good option for those parents who, you know, have kind of tried different public schools and, you know, they might not be something like your school in their area? There's sometimes the charter or the private schools, but, you know, especially coming out of the pandemic and hopefully in the 21-22 school year of most schools being in person, where do you think some of these parents should be looking?
My greatest wish is parents who are able would homeschool their children. However, I also know that there's a lot of intricacies involved in that. There's a lot of confidence. A lot of parents don't have the confidence. Some parents don't have the actual knowledge to be able to do it. I get it. My answer for any parent is wherever you have to send your kid, whether it's homeschool, micro school, private school, charter school, public school, know for yourself what is going on. Don't judge the grades, judge what your child knows. So we have to create a situation where there's somebody educating parents on how to advocate for their kids, as well as while we're educating the children, we can teach the children to advocate for themselves, especially as they get older. And then there has to be a way for I'm not looking for accountability for schools and all that, because it's not going to happen. I'm not looking for the schools to do their part. I'm just looking at parents, know for yourself what is going on, regardless of where your kids are going to school. And then I'm hoping that as communities and as parents, those of us who are socially sophisticated enough or academically sophisticated enough to advocate for children, that we teach those around us how to do it. And then each one teach one. And then as parents, we also have to be open to being taught how to advocate for our kids. Some parents, it's not a popular thing to say, but some parents don't have a lot of great interest in their children's education. That's a fact. People don't want to hear that. People don't want us to say that, but it's the truth. Okay. We'll still work with them to the degree that they'll let us. But then for those who are interested in their children's education and who do want the help, we need to get out there and we need to teach them how to advocate for their children, not only in a broken system, but also in a working system, wherever their kids go to school. Homeschool is my first shot. If you have to send your kids to public school, do so, but be very aware at all times what's going on with your kids, what's going on with them socially, what's going on in their classroom, what are they learning? Are they learning it? Are they learning things that you're okay with? Do you want them to learn everything that they're teaching? You have to be up front and center. If you're trusting grades and if you're trusting the system, you and your child will suffer.
And I think that that's key for especially those parents of younger children who are starting school or you know, in the younger grades. There's not really many districts or charters that have such a thing as a parent university, right? That teaches the parents to advocate. It's kind of just kind of learning by doing, right? Or learning through peers, right? I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your works. So you have several published works, and the digital publication you sent to me is The Reactive Thinker. And one of the publications was where you discussed social media and the tools of protesting by millennials in the digital age. You also talk about the fundamentals of success through generations, where you and other scholars explore compulsory education and the school to prison pipeline. I thought, which was a very important topic today, and as well as the student engagement. You told me that that one, Bricks to Clicks, that was a 72-hour project that was released when the decision was made last spring to shut the schools down. Can you talk a little bit about just some of these highlights of these works and what some of your findings were in the research?
Okay, so what The Refractive Thinker is, The Refractive Thinker is a doctoral anthology of doctoral level works. And the purpose of it is to put research together, but in plain language where school officials or any, whichever interested party, any stakeholder can take that book, they can read a chapter in it and immediately see how a subject or situation is affecting their organization, whether it's school or business or whatever. So my thing, of course, is usually education. Someone can open up one of my writings, like the, let's look at social media and how it has been used for social justice. People can look at how, wow, back in the civil rights era, there were marches and sit-ins and peaceful protesting, which often resulted in people being injured, dogs sicked on people, water hoses used on people. Change did come and it's still coming, but it was very, very, very slowly. However, the wielding of social media has proven to very, very swiftly bring justice in unjust situations through the cancel culture. And so we talked about that in our chapter, and we talked about the positives and negatives of using the cancel culture to get things happening. And so when, well, for example, racist people are spewing racist things on the internet, when people hear it and they're not happy about that, they immediately use the internet to find who these people are, where they work, where they go to school, where they live. And they start, they don't come after the racist. They start going to the racist connections and start saying, hey, this is your such and such here. We are not going to do business with you, or you need to do something and get them fired. And with enough public pressure, universities, employers, people will separate themselves from the person who, from the person who's not doing the right thing. Is that right or is that wrong? You know, that's for one to decide. I think that the cancel culture has done an amazing job with highlighting a lot of foul behavior from people who would otherwise stay hidden. On the other hand, there is so much possibility for damage if you identify the wrong person. And I also think that there always should be a road to redemption. How do people learn from the mistakes they've made and then are welcomed back into the fold? Nobody at 18, 19 years old should pay the rest of their adult life for something that they said, whether they meant it or not. When they were 18 years old, when they're 28, they're a different person. When they're 38, they're usually a different person. When they're 48, they're a different person than they were 30 years prior. Where's that road to redemption? How do we invite people to learn from their mistakes and give them another chance? You have to do that. You have to give people an opportunity to grow. It is, to me, it is so wrong to just push somebody out with no ability to come back, because you've made mistakes, I've made mistakes, we've said things we didn't mean, or we've said things we shouldn't have said. Thank God for the fact that when we grew up, there was no internet to get in trouble on, you know, so, you know, but now people say things, and then people are also so sensitive, unfortunately, that sometimes people say things that came out wrong, but that's not what they meant, and that's not where they were going. But yet social sensitivity is so sensitive that they just hit people with, oh, you're this. And it, So,
yeah, you know, you're especially seeing that with people in the public eye, whether it be celebrities, journalists, things like that. And sometimes they said something on a TV show, many years prior.
Yes.
Or they had a tweet many years prior, and yes, then they're getting hit with it now. So I think that talks a little bit about the other article about, it's entitled "Why Can't Professional Educators Discuss the Elephants in the Room? The Undiscussables of Culture and How the Undiscussables Arise When Questions or Comments from Either Perspective Arise." Mm-hmm. And the issues with faculty censoring, because that's very important now. We're about a month after the insurrection at the Capitol, and there were a lot of emails sent out to educators on email lists I'm on about discussing the insurrection in the classroom, and especially at the secondary level, where I taught mostly, there was a lot of during my teaching career there were certain things you just couldn't discuss, right? So I think that the article that you wrote, what are your kind of opinions on what did you find out during your research about just bringing up more of these culturally sensitive topics into the classroom, and why it's so much more important, and why we need to do it in a professional manner, but how to kind of weave that into curriculum, whether we teach math, language arts, social studies, or foreign language.
Well, I know when we wrote about the elephant in the room, in that research, I was able to come across several situations where the same thing was the outcome. If you say anything that has anything to do with, let's say, race, we'll use race, anything for you to speak about an observation that you had or an experience that you've had, depending on who you're speaking to, you could be quickly labeled a racist. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, just because you shared an experience that you had and somebody did not like what you shared, or maybe it made a group or an individual that you're speaking about look or come across a certain way, which is usually negative. The problem is we have weaponized the word racist so deeply that we won't even have a conversation about race issues. We have them amongst our own groups. And maybe if we have close friends of different races, we talk. Mm-hmm. But as far as just, like on Twitter or social Facebook or just in a group conversation to discuss anything of racial nature, people are just hands off. You can see it on Twitter whenever somebody will post something about race. If race is mentioned in it, most people will stay hands off. They won't touch it. It's a shame, because we learn through dialogue.
Yeah.
We learn through sharing our experiences. Whatever issues that I've had or I see, and I'll use the Capitol insurrection as an example. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's so much that polarizes America when it comes to race. Mm-hmm. The insurrection is really a good example of how people of color are dealt with in protest situations, and how white Americans or white people were dealt with. Clearly, two separate perspectives. They're two separate approaches there. It would be wonderful if we could sit down and talk about what we saw and what we think. This is why I feel this way. Well, no, it's no different for us. This is why. Can we talk about it so I can hear what you have to say, or you can hear what I have to say? No, we can't even talk about it. All we can do is stay in cyberspace and get on social media and fire arrows, but we can't sit up and have a dialogue, respectfully discussing what we saw versus what we experienced. So a lot of people in my inner circle, Black and otherwise, we joke, but not joke, by saying they would have even let us walk on the grass. the second our foot hit the grass, mm-hmm. they're like, get off the grass. We would have never gotten, never do we believe we would have ever gotten so close to be able to break a window and get in there. No way. Mm-hmm. The bunch of people who did that broke in, got in, and then were allowed to leave. Somebody, can we talk about this? We can't talk about it. That just like, are you kidding me? But we can't even talk about it mm-hmm. because anything racial, whether it makes sense or not, yeah. there's a race component there. Nobody wants to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm not a racist for bringing it up. I'm not a racist for pointing out the disparity in treatment. What I want to do is discuss it.
Yeah,
because you can't fix what you don't acknowledge. Mm-hmm. You can't fix it. So how are we ever going to fix it if we can't talk about it? Mm-hmm. We can talk about it in our own little groups, but we can't openly talk about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What a lost opportunity to learn from one another. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that elephant in the room at the doctoral level, why are we not mature enough to have a conversation about tough things? We've mm-hmm. reached the pinnacle of education. We can't sit down and have a civil discussion about race or culture or gender or sexual orientation or tomatoes versus apples. We can't do that. Why? Because society has decided anybody who doesn't agree with whatever it is that their agenda is, you are a racist or mm-hmm. a sexist or a xenophobe or. Mm-hmm. Well, then what's the purpose of education? What's the purpose? Why is it that we can't discuss anything? And so we become so sensitive and so politically correct that we can't even have a discussion about anything. And we are educators, doctoral level educators. So in the universities, can't have a conversation. Even if it gets a little, heated, we can't have a conversation. And that's sad mm-hmm. because growth and opportunities for growth are lost in the lack of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure hoping that, after the events of the past summer and, the Black Lives Matter and all the killings that really were center at attention and then with the insurrection in January, that, that becomes more commonplace too, to have those discussions in the, the high school classroom, in the college classroom, and, among peer groups, both adult and children peer groups. And, I know, like you said, it takes time. And I like how you pointed out how, there is that discrepancy between, the social justice movement in the 60s, where we saw things on TV, or I wasn't around then, but that was broadcast on TV, right? But that wasn't something people were commenting about, in real time, right? People didn't have the social media back then, but, and that's, like you're saying, people are kind of hiding away from those live events and not really, putting their true beliefs out there for fear of repercussions, right? Mm-hmm. There's dialogue that needs to be had, and I think there need with so much division in the country, I think there has to be more openness and willingness to come together and just find a way to have less division. I wanted to talk a little bit about a story you told me in the pre-chat about a student with ADHD, and it was a really inspiring story about taking the student to see The Lion King. Oh,
yeah. So this little guy is 5 years old, and his behavior was the absolute most. And a single parent family, his dad was in recovery, and he's very open about that. Mm-hmm. He's in recovery. And so here you have this this kid, and he has no siblings, it's just he and dad. And, the behavior was a mess. And, I worked with dad pretty closely and gave dad some strategies around discipline and consistency. But in the meantime, I worked closely with the little fellow. And I loved him very much, and I still love him very much. And so one of the things that I like to do is let students experience things, because experiences have the potential to drive change in our lives. Mm-hmm. If we don't know that there's a whole nother side of the world to see, then we won't ever endeavor to go, because all we know is our little, you know, patch of land where we've lived and grown up and we've never left. And so one of the things that I, in my own education program, like Safari Small Schools, mm-hmm. and as my students got older and left for other schools or other districts, the kids who I was able to continue to work with, I've always taken them out, taken mm-hmm. them to places, taken them to restaurants so they can understand that there's more than fast food and there's other things to do. Well, this little guy, I like the arts, and this little guy, his behavior had gotten to the point where when he's with me, I didn't have to worry about behavior. Mm-hmm. And so I asked his dad, he moved to a different district. So because he was in another district, I could hang out with this kid. Mm-hmm. So I asked his dad, hey, I'd like to take him to see the Lion King. Mm-hmm. They had a matinee here in Dallas, and you know, the tickets were a really good price. And so dad was all for it. And my little guy and I, we went to go see the Lion King. Mm-hmm. And he loved it. He loved the animals. And have you seen The Lion King on stage?
No, just the movie.
Oh, it's beautiful. They have animal costumes and the music, and it's very, very beautiful. It's in the aisles, and so you can see dancers and people moving around, and you could be in your seat and here they come right by you in the aisle, and it's great. It's a great experience. I took my own son when he was 7, and so I got to see it again with this little one, and bless his heart, you know, he made it all the way up to the middle part of the show, uh-huh. and he was done. You know, ADHD is what mm-hmm. it is. So
yeah.
He enjoyed it, but he had sat long enough. He was ready to go. And so we went to, after that, you know, he was like, okay, I'm ready to go. And you know what? Okay, let's go. Mm-hmm. Because he sat through all of that. And for someone with ADHD, that can be hard. And it kept his attention. No need to push it any farther. We had a wonderful time. And I believe there's a picture of us on my school website. I think mm-hmm. that there's one there. And that is what my goal in Safari Small Schools is, especially when I only have 5. Mm-hmm. And is to take kids to go see things. Mm-hmm. Take them to go eat. Yeah. Take them to go, because we will have, you know, we have a community component where we do things in the community. We do things away from the school. And so I look forward to, you know, buying 6 tickets for the next time the Lion King comes, or the aquarium, or mm-hmm. things that, you know, the Greek festival, the cherry blossom festival. Yeah. You know, the things that kids probably would never, ever even think of going to. I look forward to being able to take them to things like that. So that's my story of taking my little friend to the Lion King. That was one of my best memories in education, because he enjoyed it and I enjoyed being with him, little guy.
Yeah, and really could see how your face lights up when you're talking about that little guy and how he enjoyed it. And
yeah,
I wanted to talk about one more topic, and that was about your beliefs on pushing literacy more. In the pre-chat, you kind of likened pushing literacy to getting flu shots when it's flu season, right? And just that, you know, literacy should be pushed in the community, not just through schools, but like, you know, via, obviously the library's doing it, but, you know, just through just wherever you go, right? For those youngsters, and, you know, the fact that we're in a society where more and more students at, you know, those young elementary grades are on the iPad a lot more than they should be reading, right? You know, the parents complain, oh, my kid doesn't like reading. Well, how many hours do they spend on the iPad?
Yeah, exactly. What I'd love to see is just like as it related to the flu shot, just like, you know, every time you go to the doctor or every time you go to the pharmacy, it's like, have you had your flu shot? Have you had your flu shot? What I wish is, how many minutes are you reading every day? Maybe places like the doctor's office, the benefits office, Social Security, welfare, housing, the bank, anywhere that you have to go into. There should always be a section where there's books for children and adults if necessary, but there's always in the grocery store everywhere. How many minutes are you reading? How's your reading coming along? Did you know that you could get books here? Or did you know you can get reading there? If we it's if we had constant reminders when you go take a baby to a well visit, how many minutes are you reading to the baby? Now you've got, you know, 2-year-old, 3-year-old. You know, how many minutes are you reading to your child? Okay, how many minutes are you? Oh, I think my son has an ear infection. Sure, bring him in. And he's looking, how many minutes are you reading to your son? How many minutes is he reading? Or how, you know, how's his reading now? How many words is he up to? That should be a part of every evaluation wherever you go. At the end of the checkout line, there's free books. In fact, it could be a book trade. You know, you have one, bring it back. And you can take, you know, bring one, put it back, and take another one. If we pushed literacy like that, it would get to the point where it's always in your head. Kids on their own will be, they will enjoy being able to answer, I read 2 books, I read 3 books, or whatever they read. Heaven forbid if you have a sticker or a little tattoo or something that you will give them. You did, really? Oh my goodness, here's a tattoo for you. Can you imagine how much more literacy would be important if everywhere, car dealership, it doesn't matter, wherever you go, somebody or a sign is saying something about reading. Did you read your 20 minutes today? Did you read 5 minutes today? Don't forget, read today. That would be amazing, and it's completely free. Just the verbal reminder doesn't cost anything.
Yeah, and I think that was pushed more like I grew up, or I was in the elementary school in the early 80s. And, you know, I think just thinking back, you know, I think that was kind of more in the society then and more, you know, I would say a priority, right? And now that we're more and more into the digital age, I mean, there are parents who don't have TVs or don't let their kids, you know, use electronics outside of school, but you know, there are so many parents that just have that as a okay entertainment, right, for their kids. And I just think, you know, we do need to kind of get back to that time where, okay, it's important to read. We can learn so much. I mean, I teach a student private tutoring who she's always talking about the books. She's 13 and she's always talking about the books that she's reading. And she, you know, reads these like 7 books a week. I mean, she's just a real read, you know. I'm like, wow, you know, in this day and age, you know, a
Yeah,
13 year
that's
old
good
is
stuff.
really excited about reading.
That's
And
good.
so, but
That's
it's like,
good stuff.
how
I'm
many
like,
do you get come
yes.
across these days who are just, you know, they're passionate, they get a ton of books out of the library. And I think, you know, just through community effort and I think just kind of nationwide effort, let's hope that, you know, kids can, because they have so many things to learn and there's always books being published. I mean, you could read them in the digital format, but, you know, there's so many things you can learn about culture and race and the, you know, just current event topics also through reading and, you know, that are at those children's levels. So I really enjoyed having you on the podcast today and just hearing about your experience and your small school and just how you set that up and your vision for the children that you serve. Out of everything we talked about, what's one thing in particular you'd like listeners to remember?
That don't trust anybody with your children's education. Don't trust what I say. Don't trust what the school says. Don't trust what the grades on the report card says. Don't trust anything or anybody. You know for yourself what your child can do. Have your child read to you. Ask your child about elements of the story to ensure that they understand. Have your children write. So you can see how they're writing. How's the punctuation? Capitalization, is it all one giant paragraph? Or does your child know how to indent? Does your child stay within the margins, or are they writing all over the side of the paper? Just because the teacher will accept it that way doesn't mean you have to accept it that way. If it's a mess, you set the standard for your kids, and then you also let the teacher know it is not okay for my kid to just brush past the margins and keep going. My kid needs to stay within the margins and make sure that they adhere to that. I've had teachers tell me, as long as I can read it, that's okay. But my son knew better. Like, no, that's a mess and it's not okay. And no. And so I had to tell them, you raised the bar with him. And then, of course, I had to make sure that my son turned it in as well. But yeah, just don't trust me. Don't trust the schools. Don't trust anybody. Know for yourself what's going on with your child, because ultimately, it is the parents' responsibility to make sure our children are learning. The school is tasked with doing it, but we are ultimately responsible to make sure it's happening.
Yeah, I really like that, because you know, thinking about my own oldest in middle school and how, you know, he tries to slide and get things by, and it's like, no, you can't turn it in like that, right? So I'm experiencing the like same that. Thing.
Yeah, exactly. And after a while, you're just like, oh, let me see before you turn it in. And then after a while, they just get tired of rewriting it and they'll do it correctly. And so I tell, you know, I told my son's teachers, absolutely not. If his handwriting is sloppy, then make him correct that. And so, you know, it's our own standard. We have to have a high standard for our kids. So our kids are working for our standard, not for someone else's lower standard. So, yeah. But I mean, you know, it doesn't matter where you send your kids. Don't trust anybody. Trust what you see your child producing. That's it. It's not about grades. It's not about intent. It's about, what is my child producing? That's what matters.
Where can people find you online and connect with you?
So my email, if people want to reach out to me, and you can with any questions, I don't mind questions at all. You can email me at drsanders@safarismallschools.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Dr. Teresa Sanders, and on Facebook at Dr. Teresa Sanders. And Safari Small Schools also has a presence on Facebook and Instagram. So you can find me in all those places. Any questions you have, any concerns that you have, any questions about, hey, you know, my school or my kid's teacher said this, I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. Anybody who needs help advocating for their kid, I'll give you some strategies, no problem.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed having you on the podcast today. And
thank you, Dana.
You know, I hope, you know, you get the word out through this podcast about your school and that it grows, and, you know, they have those satellite locations in not too many years. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Dana. I appreciate it. It was so much fun.